moment made of hatred, tension, pain. The moment that broke its own elements, inverted them, triumphed, swept into a denial of all suffering, into its antithesis, into ecstasy. She came to his room from a party wearing an evening gown, expensive and fragile like a coating of ice over her body. And she leaned against the wall, feeling the rough plaster under her skin, glancing slowly at every object around her. At the crude kitchen table loaded with sheets of paper, at the steel rulers, at the towels smudged by the black prints of five fingers, at the bare boards of the floor. And she let her glance slide down the length of her shining satin, down to the small triangle of a silver sandal, thinking of how she would be undressed here. She liked to wander about the room, to throw her gloves down among a litter of pencils, rubber erasers, and rags, to put her small silver bag on a stained, discarded shirt, to snap open the catch of a diamond bracelet and drop it on a plate with the remnant of a sandwich, by an unfinished drawing. "Rourke," she said, standing behind his chair, her arms over his shoulders, her hand under his shirt, fingers spread and pressed flat against his chest. "I made Mr. Simons promise his job to Peter Keating today. 35 floors and anything he'll wish to make it cost. Money no object. Just art. Free art." She heard the sound of his soft chuckle, but he did not turn to look at her. Only his fingers closed over her wrist, and he pushed her hand farther down under his shirt, pressing it hard against his skin. Then she pulled his head back, and she bent down to cover his mouth with hers. She came in and found a copy of The Banner spread out on his table, open at the page bearing "Your House" by Dominique Francon. Her column contained the line, "Howard Rourke is the Marquis de Sade of architecture. He is in love with his buildings. And look at them." She knew that he disliked The Banner, that he put it there only for her sake, that he watched her noticing it with the half-smile she dreaded on his face. She was angry. She wanted him to read everything she wrote, yet she would have preferred to think that it hurt him enough to make him avoid it. Later, lying across the bed with his mouth on her breast, she looked past the orange tangle of his head at that sheet of newspaper on the table, and he felt her trembling with pleasure. She sat on the floor at his feet, her head pressed to his knees, holding his hand, closing her fist in turn over each of his fingers, closing it tight, and letting it slide slowly down the length of his finger, feeling the hard, small stops at the joints. And she asked softly, "Rourke, you wanted to get the Colton factory? You wanted it very badly?"
"Yes, very badly," he answered, without smiling and without pain.
Then she raised his hand to her lips and held it there for a long time. She got out of bed in the darkness and walked naked across his room to take a cigarette from the table. She bent to the light of a match, her flat stomach rounded faintly in the movement. He said, "Light one for me," and she put a cigarette between his lips. Then she wandered through the dark room, smoking, while he lay in bed, propped up on his elbow, watching her. Once she came in and found him working at his table. He said,
"I've got to finish this. Sit down. Wait."
He did not look at her again. She waited, silently, huddled in a chair at the farthest end of the room. She watched the straight lines of his eyebrows drawn in concentration, the set of his mouth, the vein beating under the tight skin of his neck, the sharp, surgical assurance of his hand. He did not look like an artist. He looked like the quarry worker, like a wrecker demolishing walls, and like a monk. Then she did not want him to stop or glance at her, because she wanted to watch the ascetic purity of his person, the absence of all sensuality, to watch that, and to think of what she remembered. There were nights when he came to her apartment, as she came to his, without warning. If she had guests, he said, "Get rid of them," and walked into the bedroom while she obeyed. They had a silent agreement, understood without mention, never to be seen together. Her bedroom was an exquisite place of glass and pale ice green. He liked to come in wearing clothes stained by a day spent on the construction site. He liked to throw back the covers of her bed, then to sit talking quietly for an hour or two, not looking at the bed,
not mentioning her writing or buildings, or the latest commission she had obtained for Peter Keating. The simplicity of being at ease here like this, making the hours more sensual than the moments they delayed. There were evenings when they sat together in her living room, at the huge window high over the city. She liked to see him at that window. He would stand half-turned to her, smoking, looking at the city below. She would move away from him and sit down on the floor in the middle of the room and watch him. Once when he got out of bed, she switched the light on and saw him standing there, naked. She looked at him. Then she said, her voice quiet and desperate with the simple despair of complete sincerity, "Rourke, everything I've done all my life is because it's the kind of a world that made you work in a quarry last summer."
"I know that."
He sat down at the foot of the bed. She moved over. She pressed her face against his thigh, curled up, her feet on the pillow, her arm hanging down, letting her palm move slowly up the length of his leg, from the ankle to the knee, and back again. She said, "But of course if it had been up to me last spring when you were broken, jobless, I would have sent you precisely to that kind of a job, in that particular quarry."
"I know that too. But maybe you wouldn't have. Maybe you'd have had me as a washroom attendant in the clubhouse of the AGA.
"Yes, possibly. Put your hand on my back, Rourke. Just hold it there, like that." She lay still, her face buried against his knees, her arm hanging down over the side of the bed, not moving, as if nothing in her were alive but the skin between her shoulder blades under his hand. In the drawing rooms she visited, in the restaurants, in the offices of the AGA, people talked about the dislike of Miss Dominique Francone of the Banner for Howard Rourke, that architectural freak of Roger Enright's. It gave him a sort of scandalous fame. It was said, "Rourke? You know, the guy Dominique Francone can't stand the guts of." "The Francone girl knows her architecture all right, and if she says he's no good, he must be worse than I thought he was."
"God, but these two must hate each other. Though I understand they haven't even met."
She liked to hear these things. It pleased her when Athelstan Beasley wrote in his column in the AGA Bulletin, discussing the architecture of medieval castles, "To understand the grim ferocity of these structures, we must remember that the wars between feudal lords were a savage business, something like the feud between Miss Dominique Francone and Mr. Howard Rourke." Austin Heller, who had been her friend, spoke to her about it. He was angrier than she had ever seen him. His face lost all the charm of his usual sarcastic poise.
"What in hell do you think you're doing, Dominique?" he snapped. "This is the greatest exhibition of journalistic hooliganism I've ever seen swilled out in public print. Why don't you leave that sort of thing to Ellsworth Toohey?"
"Ellsworth is good, isn't he?" she said. "At least he's had the decency to keep his unsanitary trap shut about Rourke. Though, of course, that too is an indecency. But what's happened to you? Do you realize who and what you're talking about? It was all right when you amused yourself by praising some horrible abortion of Grandpa Holcomb's, or panning the pants off your own father and that pretty butcher's calendar boy that he's got himself for a partner. It didn't matter one way or another. But to bring that same intellectual manner to the appraisal of someone like Rourke... You know, I really thought you had integrity and judgment, if ever given a chance to exercise them. In fact, I thought you were behaving like a tramp only to emphasize the mediocrity of the saps whose works you had to write about. I didn't think that you were just an irresponsible bitch." "You were wrong," she said. Roger Enright entered her office one morning and said without greeting,
"Get your hat. You're coming to see it with me."
"Good morning, Roger," she said. "To see what?"
"The Enright house. As much of it as we've got put up."
"Why, certainly, Roger." She smiled, rising. "I'd love to see the Enright house."
On their way, she asked,
"What's the matter, Roger? Trying to bribe me?"
He sat stiffly on the vast gray cushions of his limousine, not looking at her. He answered, "I can understand stupid malice. I can understand ignorant malice. I can't understand deliberate rottenness. You are free, of course, to write anything you wish, afterward. But it won't be stupidity, and it won't be ignorance."
"You overestimate me, Roger."
She shrugged, and said nothing else for the rest of the ride. They walked together past the wooden fence into the jungle of naked steel and planks that was to be the Enright house. Her high heels stepped lightly over lime-spattered boards, and she walked, leaning back, in careless, insolent elegance. She stopped and looked at the sky held in a frame of steel, the sky that seemed more distant than usual, thrust back by the sweeping length of beams. She looked at the steel cages of future projections, at the insolent angles, at the incredible complexity of this shape coming to life as a simple, logical whole. A naked skeleton, with planes of air to form the walls. A naked skeleton on a cold winter day, with a sense of birth and promise. Like a bare tree, with the first touch of green. Oh, Roger. He looked at her, and saw the kind of face one should expect to see in church at Easter. I didn't underestimate either one, he said dryly. Neither you nor the building. Good morning, said a low, hard voice beside them. She was not shocked to see Rourke. She had not heard him approaching, but it would have been unnatural to think of this building without him. She felt that he simply was there, that he had been there from the moment she crossed the outside fence, that this structure was he, in a manner more personal than his body. He stood before them, his hands thrust into the pockets of a loose coat, his hair hatless in the cold. "Miss Francone, Mr. Rourke," said Enright. "We have met once," she said. "At the Holcombs, if Mr. Rourke remembers."
"Of course, Miss Francone," said Rourke.
"I wanted Miss Francone to see it," said Enright.
"Shall I show you around?" Rourke asked him.
"Yes, do, please," she answered first. The three of them walked together through the structure, and the workers stared curiously at Dominique. Rourke explained the layout of future rooms, the system of elevators, the heating plant, the arrangement of windows, as he would have explained it to a contractor's assistant. She asked questions, and he answered. "How many cubic feet of space, Mr. Rourke? How many tons of steel?"
"Be careful of these pipes, Miss Francone. Step this way."
Enright walked along, his eyes on the ground, looking at nothing. But then he asked,
"How's it going, Howard?"
And Rourke smiled, answering,
"2 days ahead of schedule."
And they stood talking about the job, like brothers, forgetting her for a moment, the clanging roar of machines around them drowning out their words. She thought, standing there in the heart of the building, that if she had nothing of him, nothing but his body, here it was, offered to her, the rest of him, to be seen and touched, open to all. The girders and the conduits and the sweeping reaches of space were his, and could not have been anyone else's in the world. His, as his face, as his soul. Here was the shape he had made, and the thing within him which had caused him to make it, the end and the cause together, his motive power eloquent in every line of steel. A man's self, hers for this moment. Hers by grace of her seeing it and understanding.
"Are you tired, Miss Francone?" asked Rourke, looking at her face.
"No," she said. "No, not at all. I've been thinking. What kind of plumbing fixtures are you going to use here, Mr. Rourke?" A few days later in his room, sitting on the edge of his drafting table, she looked at a newspaper, at her column, and the lines. "I have visited the Enright construction site. I wish that in some future air raid, a bomb would blast this house out of existence. It would be a worthy ending. So much better than to see it growing old and soot-stained, degraded by the family photographs, the dirty socks, the cocktail shakers, and the grapefruit rinds of its inhabitants. There is not a person in New York City who should be allowed to live in this building." Rourke came to stand beside her, close to her, his legs pressed to her knees, and he looked down at the paper, smiling.
"You have Roger completely bewildered by this," he said.
"Has he read it?"
"I was in his office this morning when he read it. At first he called you some names I'd never heard before. Then he said, 'Wait a moment,' and he read it again. He looked up, very puzzled, but not angry at all. And he said, 'If you read it one way, but on the other hand—'"
"What did you say?"
"Nothing. You know, Dominique, I'm very grateful. But when are you going to stop handing me all that extravagant praise? Someone else might see it. and you won't like that.
Someone else?
You knew that I got it, from that first article of yours about the Enright House. You wanted me to get it. But don't you think someone else might understand your way of doing things?
Oh, yes, but the effect, for you, will be worse than if they didn't. They'll like you less for it. However, I don't know who'll even bother to understand, unless it's... Rourke, what do you think of Ellsworth Toohey?
Good God, why should anyone think of Ellsworth Toohey?
She liked the rare occasions when she met Rourke at some gathering where Heller or Enright had brought him. She liked the polite, impersonal, Miss Francone, pronounced by his voice. She enjoyed the nervous concern of the hostess and her efforts not to let them come together. She knew that the people around them expected some explosion, some shocking sign of hostility, which never came. She did not seek Rourke out, and she did not avoid him. They spoke to each other if they happened to be included in the same group, as they would have spoken to anyone else. It required no effort. It was real and right. It made everything right, even this gathering. She found a deep sense of fitness in the fact that here, among people, they should be strangers. Strangers and enemies. She thought, these people can think of many things he and I are to each other, except what we are. It made the moments she remembered greater, the moments not touched by the sight of others, by the words of others, not even by their knowledge. She thought, it has no existence here, except in me and in him. She felt a sense of possession, such as she could feel nowhere else. She could never own him as she owned him in a room among strangers, when she seldom looked in his direction. If she glanced at him across the room and saw him in conversation with blank, indifferent faces, she turned away, unconcerned. If the faces were hostile, she watched for a second, pleased. She was angry when she saw a smile, a sign of warmth or approval on a face turned to him. It was not jealousy. She did not care whether the face was a man's or a woman's. She resented the approval as an impertinence. She was tortured by peculiar things, by the street where he lived, by the doorstep of his house, by the cars that turned the corner of his block. She resented the cars in particular. She wished she could make them drive on to the next street. She looked at the garbage pail by the stoop next door, and she wondered whether it had stood there when he passed by on his way to his office this morning, whether he had looked at that crumpled cigarette package on top. Once, in the lobby of his house, she saw a man stepping out of the elevator. She was shocked for a second. She had always felt as if he were the only inhabitant of that house. When she rode up in the small self-operating elevator, she stood leaning against the wall, her arms crossed over her breast, her hands hugging her shoulders, feeling huddled and intimate, as in a stall under a warm shower. She thought of that while some gentleman was telling her about the latest show on Broadway, while Rourke was sipping a cocktail at the other end of the room, while she heard the hostess whispering to somebody, "My lord, I didn't think Gordon would bring Dominique. I know Austin will be furious at me because of his friend Rourke being here, you know." Later, lying across his bed, her eyes closed, her cheeks flushed, her lips wet, losing the sense of the rules she herself had imposed, losing the sense of her words, she whispered, "Rourke, there was a man talking to you out there today, and he was smiling at you. The fool, the terrible fool. Last week he was looking at a pair of movie comedians and loving them. I wanted to tell that man, don't look at him. You'll have no right to want to look at anything else. Don't like him. You'll have to hate the rest of the world. It's like that, you damn fool, one or the other. Not together. Not with the same eyes. Don't look at him. Don't like him. Don't approve. That's what I wanted to tell him. Not you and the rest of it. I can't bear to see that. I can't stand it. Anything to take you away from it, from their world, from all of them. Anything, Rourke." She did not hear herself saying it. She did not see him smiling. She did not recognize the full understanding in his face. She saw only his face close over hers. And she had nothing to hide from him, nothing to keep unstated. Everything was granted, answered, found. Peter Keating was bewildered. Dominique's sudden devotion to his career seemed dazzling, flattering, enormously profitable. Everybody told him so. But there were moments when he did not feel dazzled or flattered. He felt uneasy. He tried to avoid Guy Francone. "How did you do it, Peter? How did you do it?" Francone would ask. "She must be crazy about you. Who'd ever think that Dominique, of all people, would... And who'd think she could? She'd have made me a millionaire if she'd done her stuff 5 years ago. But then, of course, a father is not the same inspiration as a..." He caught an ominous look on Keating's face and changed the end of his sentence to, "as her man, shall we say." "Listen, Guy," Keating began, and stopped, sighing, and muttered, "Please, Guy, we mustn't..."
I know, we mustn't be premature. But hell, Peter, entre nous, isn't it all as public as an engagement?
More so, and louder. Then the smile vanished, and Francone's face looked earnest, peaceful, frankly aged, in one of his rare flashes of genuine dignity.
"And I'm glad, Peter," he said simply. "That's what I wanted to happen. I guess I always did love Dominique, after all. It makes me happy. I know I'll be leaving her in good hands. Her and everything else, eventually."
"Look, old man, will you forgive me? I'm so terribly rushed. Had 2 hours sleep last night. The Colton factory, you know. Jesus, what a job. Thanks to Dominique. It's a killer, but wait till you see it. Wait till you see the check, too."
"Isn't she wonderful? Will you tell me, why is she doing it? I've asked her, and I can't make head or tail of what she says. She gives me the craziest gibberish. You know how she talks.
Ah, well, we should worry, so long as she's doing it." He could not tell Francone that he had no answer. He couldn't admit that he had not seen Dominique alone for months, that she refused to see him. He remembered his last private conversation with her, in the cab on their way from Tui's meeting. He remembered the indifferent calm of her insults to him, the utter contempt of insults delivered without anger. He could have expected anything after that, except to see her turn into his champion, his press agent, almost, his pimp. "That's what's wrong," he thought, "that I can think of words like that when I think about it." He had seen her often since she started on her unrequested campaign. He had been invited to her parties and introduced to his future clients. He had never been allowed a moment alone with her. He had tried to thank her and to question her, but he could not force a conversation she did not want continued, with a curious mob of guests pressing all around them. So he went on smiling blandly, her hand resting casually on the black sleeve of his dinner jacket, her thigh against his as she stood beside him, her pose possessive and intimate, made flagrantly intimate by her air of not noticing it, while she told an admiring circle what she thought of the Cosmos Slotnick building. He heard envious comments from all his friends. He was, he thought bitterly, the only man in New York City who did not think that Dominique Francone was in love with him. But he knew the dangerous instability of her whims, and this was too valuable a whim to disturb. He stayed away from her and sent her flowers. He rode along and tried not to think of it. The little edge remained, a thin edge of uneasiness. One day he met her by chance in a restaurant. He saw her lunching alone and grasped the opportunity. He walked straight to her table, determined to act like an old friend who remembered nothing but her incredible benevolence. After many bright comments on his luck, he asked, "Dominique, why have you been refusing to see me?" "What should I have wanted to see you for?" "But good Lord Almighty!" That came out involuntarily, with too sharp a sound of long-suppressed anger, and he corrected it hastily, smiling. "Well, don't you think you owed me a chance to thank you?" "You thanked me, many times." "Yes, but didn't you think we really had to meet alone? Didn't you think that I'd be a little... bewildered?" "I haven't thought of it." "Yes, I suppose you could be." "Well?"
"Well, what?"
"What is it all about?"
"About $50,000 by now, I think."
"You're being nasty."
"Want me to stop?"
"Oh, no. That is, not
the commissions." "Fine, I won't stop them."
"You see? What was there for us to talk about?"
"I'm doing things for you, and you're glad to have me do them. So we're in perfect agreement."
"You do say the funniest things."
"In perfect agreement."
That's sort of a redundancy and an understatement at the same time, isn't it?
"What else could we be under the circumstances?
You wouldn't expect me to object to what you're doing, would you?"
"No.
I wouldn't. But agreeing is not the word for what I feel. I'm so terribly grateful to you that I'm simply dizzy. I was bowled over. Don't let me get silly now. I know you don't like that. But I'm so grateful I don't know what to do with myself.
Fine, Peter. Now you've thanked me.
You see, I've never flattered myself by thinking that you thought very much of my work, or cared, or took any notice. And then you... That's what makes me so happy. And...
Dominique? He asked, and his voice jerked a little, because the question was like a hook pulling at a line, long and hidden, and he knew that this was the core of his uneasiness.
Do you really think that I'm a great architect?
She smiled slowly. She said,
Peter, if people heard you asking that, they'd laugh. Particularly asking that of me.
Yes, I know, but... But do you really mean them? All those things you say about me.
They work?
Yes, but is that why you picked me?
Because you think I'm good?
You sell like hotcakes.
Isn't that the proof?
Yes.
No.
I mean, in a different way.
I mean...
Dominique, I'd like to hear you say once, just once, that I...
Listen, Peter, I'll have to run along in a moment, but before I go, I must tell you that you'll probably hear from Mrs. Lonsdale tomorrow or the next day. Now, remember that she's a prohibitionist, loves dogs, hates women who smoke, and believes in reincarnation. She wants her house to be better than Mrs. Purdy's. Holcomb did Purdy's. So if you tell her that Mrs. Purdy's house looks ostentatious, and that true simplicity costs much more money, you'll get along fine. You might discuss Petty Point, too. That's her hobby.
He went away, thinking happily about Mrs. Lonsdale's house, and he forgot his question. Later he remembered it resentfully, and shrugged, and told himself that the best part of Dominique's help was her desire not to see him. As a compensation, he found pleasure in attending the meetings of TUI's Council of American Builders. He did not know why he should think of it as compensation, but he did, and it was comforting. He listened attentively when Gordon L. Prescott made a speech on the meaning of architecture. And thus the intrinsic significance of our craft lies in the philosophical fact that we deal in nothing. We create emptiness through which certain physical bodies are to move. We shall designate them for convenience as humans. By emptiness, I mean what is commonly known as rooms. Thus, it is only the crass layman who thinks that we put up stone walls. We do nothing of the kind. We put up emptiness, as I have proved. This leads us to a corollary of astronomical importance, to the unconditional acceptance of the premise that absence is superior to presence, that is, to the acceptance of non-acceptance. I shall state this in simpler terms. For the sake of clarity, nothing is superior to something. Thus it is clear that the architect is more than a bricklayer, since the fact of bricks is a secondary illusion anyway. The architect is a metaphysical priest dealing in basic essentials who has the courage to face the primal conception of reality as non-reality, since there is nothing, and he creates nothingness. If this sounds like a contradiction, it is not a proof of bad logic, but of a higher logic, the dialectics of all life and art. Should you wish to make the inevitable deductions from this basic conception, you may come to conclusions of vast sociological importance. You may see that a beautiful woman is inferior to a non-beautiful one, that the literate is inferior to the illiterate, that the rich is inferior to the poor and the able to the incompetent. The architect is the concrete illustration of a cosmic paradox. Let us be modest in the vast pride of this realization. Everything else is twaddle. One could not worry about one's value or greatness when listening to this. It made self-respect unnecessary. Keating listened in thick contentment. He glanced at the others. There was an attentive silence in the audience. They all liked it, as he liked it. He saw a boy chewing gum, a man cleaning his fingernails with the corner of a match folder, a youth stretched out loutishly. That, too, pleased Keating. It was as if they said, "We are glad to listen to the sublime, but it's not necessary to be too damn reverent about the sublime." The Council of American Builders met once a month, and engaged in no tangible activity beyond listening to speeches and sipping an inferior brand of root beer. Its membership did not grow fast, either in quantity or in quality. There were no concrete results achieved.
The meetings of the council were held in a huge empty room over a garage on the west side. A long, narrow, unventilated stairway led to a door bearing the council's name. There were folding chairs inside, a table for the chairman, and a wastebasket. The AGA considered the Council of American Builders a silly joke.
"What do you want to waste time on those cranks for?" Francone asked Keating, in the rose-lit, satin-stuffed rooms of the AGA,
wrinkling his nose with fastidious amusement.
"Damned if I know," Keating answered gaily. "I like them."
Ellsworth, too, he attended every meeting of the council, but did not speak. He sat in a corner and listened. One night Keating and Toohey walked home together after the meeting, down the dark, shabby streets of the west side, and stopped for a cup of coffee at a seedy drugstore.
"Why not a drugstore?"
Toohey laughed when Keating reminded him of the distinguished restaurants made famous by Toohey's patronage.
"At least no one will recognize us here and bother us."
He sent a jet of smoke from his Egyptian cigarette at a faded Coca-Cola sign over their booth. He ordered a sandwich. He nibbled daintily at a slice of pickle, which was not fly-specked, but looked it. And he talked to Keating. He talked at random. What he said did not matter at first. It was his voice, the matchless voice of Ellsworth Toohey. Keating felt as if he were standing in the middle of a vast plain, under the stars, held and owned, in assurance, in security.
"Kindness, Peter," said the voice softly. "Kindness. That is the first commandment, perhaps the only one. That is why I had to pan that new play in my column yesterday. That play lacked essential kindness. We must be kind, Peter, to everybody around us. We must accept and forgive. There is so much to be forgiven in each one of us. If you learn to love everything, the humblest, the least, the meanest, then the meanest in you will be loved. Then we'll find the sense of universal equality, the great peace of brotherhood, a new world, Peter, a beautiful new world."
Chapter 9. Ellsworth Monckton Toohey was 7 years old when he turned the hose upon Johnny Stokes, as Johnny was passing by the Toohey lawn, dressed in his best Sunday suit. Johnny had waited for that suit a year and a half, his mother being very poor. Ellsworth did not sneak or hide, but committed his act openly, with systematic deliberation. He walked to the tap, turned it on, stood in the middle of the lawn, and directed the hose at Johnny, his aim faultless, with Johnny's mother just a few steps behind him down the street, with his own mother and father and the visiting minister in full view on the Toohey porch. Johnny Stokes was a bright kid with dimples and golden curls. People always turned to look at Johnny Stokes. Nobody had ever turned to look at Ellsworth Toohey. The shock and amazement of the grown-ups present were such that nobody rushed to stop Ellsworth for a long moment. He stood bracing his thin little body against the violence of the nozzle jerking in his hands, never allowing it to leave its objective until he felt satisfied. Then he let it drop, the water hissing through the grass, and made 2 steps toward the porch and stopped, waiting, his head high, delivering himself for punishment. The punishment would have come from Johnny if Mrs. Stokes had not seized her boy and held him. Ellsworth did not turn to the Stokeses behind him, but said slowly, distinctly, looking at his mother and the minister, "Johnny is a dirty bully. He beats up all the boys in school." This was true. The question of punishment became an ethical problem. It was difficult to punish Ellsworth under any circumstances because of his fragile body and delicate health. Besides, it seemed wrong to chastise a boy who had sacrificed himself to avenge injustice, and done it bravely, in the open, ignoring his own physical weakness. Somehow, he looked like a martyr. Ellsworth did not say so. He said nothing further, but his mother said it. The minister was inclined to agree with her. Ellsworth was sent to his room without supper. He did not complain. He remained there meekly, refused the food his mother sneaked up to him late at night, disobeying her husband. Mr. Toohey insisted on paying Mrs. Stokes for Johnny's suit. Mrs. Toohey let him do it, sullenly. She did not like Mrs. Stokes. Ellsworth's father managed the Boston branch of a national chain of shoe stores. He earned a modest, comfortable salary and owned a modest, comfortable home in an undistinguished suburb of Boston. The secret sorrow of his life was that he did not hit a business of his own, but he was a quiet, conscientious, unimaginative man, and an early marriage had ended all his ambition. Ellsworth's mother was a thin, restless woman who adopted and discarded 5 religions in 9 years. She had delicate features, the kind that made her look beautiful for a few years of her life, at the one period of full flower, never before and never afterward. Ellsworth was her idol. His sister Helen, 5 years older, was a good-natured, unremarkable girl, not beautiful, but pretty and healthy. She presented no problem. Ellsworth, however, had been born puny in health. His mother adored him from the moment the doctor pronounced him unfit to survive. It made her grow in spiritual stature, to know the extent of her own magnanimity in her love for so uninspiring an object. The bluer and uglier baby Ellsworth looked, the more passionate grew her love for him. She was almost disappointed when he survived without becoming an actual cripple. She took little interest in Helen. There was no martyrdom in loving Helen. The girl was so obviously more deserving of love that it seemed just to deny it to her. Mr. Toohey, for reasons which he could not explain, was not too fond of his son. Ellsworth, however, was the ruler of the household by a tacit, voluntary submission of both parents, though his father could never understand the cause of his own share in that submission. In the evenings, under the lamp of the family sitting room, Mrs. Toohey would begin in a tense, challenging voice, angry and defeated in advance.
"Horace, I want a bicycle for Ellsworth. All the boys his age have them. Willie Lovett just got a new one the other day. Horace? Horace, I want a bicycle for Ellsworth."
"Not right now, Mary," Mr. Toohey would answer wearily.
"Maybe next summer. Just now we can't afford."
Mrs. Toohey would argue, her voice rising in jerks toward a shriek.
"Mother, what for?" said Ellsworth, his voice soft, rich, and clear, lower than the voices of his parents, yet cutting across them, commanding, strangely persuasive.
"There's many things we need more than a bicycle. What do you care about Willie Lovett?"
"I don't like Willie. Willie's a dumbbell. Willie can afford it because his pa's got his own dry goods store. His pa's a show-off. I don't want a bicycle."
Every word of this was true, and Ellsworth did not want a bicycle. But Mr. Toohey looked at him strangely, wondering what had made him say that. He saw his son's eyes looking at him blankly from behind the small glasses. The eyes were not ostentatiously sweet, not reproachful, not malicious, just blank. Mr. Toohey felt that he should be grateful for his son's understanding, and wished to hell the boy had not mentioned that part about the private store. Ellsworth did not get the bicycle, but he got a polite attention in the house, a respectful solicitude, tender and guilty from his mother, uneasy and suspicious from his father. Mr. Toohey would do anything rather than be forced into a conversation with Ellsworth, feeling, at the same time, foolish and angry at himself for his fear.
"So I want a new suit for Ellsworth. I saw one in a window today, and I've..."
"Mother, I've got 4 suits. What do I need another one for? I don't want to look silly like Pat Noonan, who changes them every day. That's because his pa's got his own ice cream parlor. Pat stuck up like a girl about his clothes. I don't want to be a sissy."
Ellsworth, thought Mrs. Toohey at times, happy and frightened, is going to be a saint. He doesn't care about material things at all, not one bit. This was true. Ellsworth did not care about material things. He was a thin, pale boy with a bad stomach, and his mother had to watch his diet, as well as his tendency to frequent colds in the head. His sonorous voice was astonishing in his puny frame. He sang in the choir, where he had no rivals. At school he was a model pupil. He always knew his lessons, had the neatest copybooks, the cleanest fingernails, loved Sunday school, and preferred reading to athletic games, in which he had no chance. He was not too good at mathematics, which he disliked, but excellent at history, English, civics, and penmanship. Later at psychology and sociology. He studied conscientiously and hard. He was not like Johnny Stokes, who never listened in class, seldom opened a book at home, yet knew everything almost before the teacher had explained it. Learning came to Johnny automatically, as did all things. His able little fists, his healthy body, his startling good looks, his over-exuberant vitality. But Johnny did the shocking and the unexpected. Ellsworth did the expected, better than anyone had ever seen it done. When they came to compositions, Johnny would stun the class by some brilliant display of rebellion. Given the theme of school days, the golden age, Johnny came through with a masterly essay on how he hated school and why. Ellsworth delivered a prose poem on the glory of school days, which was reprinted in a local newspaper. Besides, Ellsworth had Johnny beaten hollow when it came to names and dates. Ellsworth's memory was like a spread of liquid cement. It held anything that fell upon it. Johnny was a shooting geyser. Ellsworth was a sponge. The children called him Elsie Toohey. They usually let him have his way and avoided him when possible, but not openly. They could not figure him out. He was helpful and dependable when they needed assistance with their lessons. He had a sharp wit and could ruin any child by the apt nickname he coined, the kind that hurt. He drew devastating cartoons on fences. He had all the earmarks of a sissy, but somehow he could not be classified as one. He had too much self-assurance and quiet, disturbingly wise contempt for everybody. He was afraid of nothing. He would march right up to the strongest boys in the middle of the street and state, not yell, in a clear voice that carried for blocks, state without anger. No one had ever seen Ellsworth Toohey angry. Johnny Stokes got a patch on his ass. Johnny Stokes lives in a rented flat. Willie Lovett is a dunce. Pat Noonan is a fish eater. Johnny never gave him a beating, and neither did the other boys, because Ellsworth wore glasses. He could not take part in ball games, and was the only child who boasted about it, instead of feeling frustrated or ashamed like the other boys with substandard bodies. He considered athletics vulgar, and said so. The brain, he said, was mightier than the brawn. He meant it. He had no close personal friends. He was considered impartial and incorruptible. There were two incidents in his childhood, of which his mother was very proud. It happened that the wealthy, popular Willie Lovett gave a birthday party on the same day as Drippy Munn, son of a widowed seamstress, a whining boy whose nose was always running. Nobody accepted Drippy's invitation, except the children who were never invited anywhere. Of those asked for both occasions, Ellsworth Toohey was the only one who snubbed Willie Lovett and went to Drippy Munn's party, a miserable affair from which he expected and received no pleasure. Willie Lovett's enemies howled and taunted Willie for months afterward about being passed up in favor of Drippy Munn. It happened that Pat Noonan offered Ellsworth a bag of jelly beans in exchange for a surreptitious peek at his test paper. Ellsworth took the jelly beans and allowed Pat to copy his test. A week later, Ellsworth marched up to the teacher, laid the jelly beans untouched upon her desk, and confessed his crime without naming the other culprit. All her efforts to extract that name could not budge him. Ellsworth remained silent. He explained only that the guilty boy was one of the best students, and he could not sacrifice the boy's record to the demands of his own conscience. He was the only one punished, kept after school for 2 hours. Then the teacher had to drop the matter and let the test marks remain as they were. But it threw suspicion on the grades of Johnny Stokes, Pat Noonan, and all the best pupils of the class, except Ellsworth Toohey. Ellsworth was 11 years old when his mother died. Aunt Adeline, his father's maiden sister, came to live with him and run the Toohey household. Aunt Adeline was a tall, capable woman to whom the word horse clung in conjunction with the words sense and face. The secret sorrow of her life was that she had never inspired romance. Helen became her immediate favorite. She considered Ellsworth an imp out of hell. But Ellsworth never wavered in his manner of grave courtesy toward Aunt Adeline. He leaped to pick up her handkerchief, to move her chair when they had company, particularly masculine company. He sent her beautiful valentines on the appropriate day, with paper lace, rosebuds, and love poems. He sang Sweet Adeline at the top of his town crier's voice. "You're a maggot, Elsie," she told him once. "You feed on sores." "Then I'll never starve," he answered. After a while, they reached a state of armed neutrality. Ellsworth was left to grow up as he pleased. In high school, Ellsworth became a local celebrity, the star orator. For years, the school did not refer to a promising boy as a good speaker, but as a Toohey. He won every contest. Afterward, members of the audience spoke about that beautiful boy. They did not remember the sorry little figure with the sunken chest, inadequate legs and glasses. They remembered the voice. He won every debate. He could prove anything. Once, after beating Willie Lovett with the affirmative of "the pen is mightier than the sword," he challenged Willie to reverse their positions, took the negative, and won again. Until the age of 16, Ellsworth felt himself drawn to the career of a minister. He thought a great deal about religion. He talked about God and the Spirit. He read extensively on the subject. He read more books on the history of the church than on the substance of faith. He brought his audience to tears in one of his greatest oratorical triumphs with the theme of "the meek shall inherit the earth." At this period, he began to acquire friends. He liked to speak of faith, and he found those who liked to listen. Only, he discovered that the bright, the strong, the able boys of his class felt no need of listening, felt no need of him at all. But the suffering and the ill-endowed came to him. Drippy Munn began to follow him about with the silent devotion of a dog. Billy Wilson lost his mother and came wandering to the Toohey house in the evenings to sit with Ellsworth on the porch, listening, shivering once in a while, saying nothing, his eyes wide, dry, and pleading. Skinny Dick's got infantile paralysis and would lie in bed watching the street corner beyond the window waiting for Ellsworth. Rusty Hazleton failed to pass in his grades and sat for many hours crying, with Ellsworth's cold, steady hand on his shoulder. It was never clear whether they all discovered Ellsworth, or Ellsworth discovered them. It seemed to work more like a law of nature. As nature allows no vacuum, so Payne and Ellsworth Toohey drew each other. His rich, beautiful voice said to them, "It's good to suffer. Don't complain. Bear, bow, accept, and be grateful that God has made you suffer, for this makes you better than the people who are laughing and happy. If you don't understand this, don't try to understand. Everything bad comes from the mind, because the mind asks too many questions. It is blessed to believe, not to understand. So if you didn't get passing grades, be glad of it. It means that you are better than the smart boys who think too much and too easily." People said it was touching the way Ellsworth's friends clung to him. After they had taken him for a while, they could not do without him. It was like a drug habit. Ellsworth was 15 when he astonished the Bible class teacher by an odd question. The teacher had been elaborating upon the text, "What shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" Ellsworth asked, "Then, in order to be truly wealthy, a man should collect souls?" The teacher was about to ask him what the hell did he mean, but controlled himself and asked, "What did he mean?" Ellsworth would not elucidate. At the age of 16, Ellsworth lost interest in religion. He discovered socialism. His transition shocked Aunt Adeline. "In the first place, it is blasphemous and drivel," she said. "In the second place, it doesn't make sense. I'm surprised at you, Elsie. The poor in spirit, that was fine, but just the poor? That doesn't sound respectable at all. Besides, it's not like you. You're not cut out to make big trouble, only little trouble. Something's crazy somewhere, Elsie. It just don't fit. It's not like you at all." "In the first place, my dear aunt," he answered, "don't call me Elsie. In the second place, you're wrong." The change seemed to be good for Ellsworth. He did not become an aggressive zealot. He became gentler, quieter, milder. He became more attentively considerate of people. It was as if something had taken the nervous edges off his personality and given him new confidence. Those around him began to like him. Aunt Adeline stopped worrying. Nothing actual seemed to come of his preoccupation with revolutionary theories. He joined no political party. He read a great deal, and he attended a few dubious meetings where he spoke once or twice, not too well, but mostly sat in a corner listening, watching, thinking. Ellsworth went to Harvard. His mother had willed her life insurance for that specific purpose. At Harvard, his scholastic record was superlative. He majored in history. Aunt Adeline had expected to see him go in for economics and sociology. She half feared that he would end up as a social worker. He didn't. He became absorbed in literature and the fine arts. It baffled her a little. It was a new trait in him. He had never shown any particular tendency in that direction. "You're not the arty kind, Elsie," she stated. "It don't fit." "You're wrong, Auntie," he said. Ellsworth's relations with his fellow students were the most unusual of his achievements at Harvard. He made himself accepted. Among the proud young descendants of proud old names, he did not hide the fact of his humble background. He exaggerated it. He did not tell them that his father was the manager of a shoe store. He said that his father was a shoe cobbler. He said it without defiance, bitterness, or proletarian arrogance. He said it as if it were a joke on him, and, if one looked closely into his smile, on them. He acted like a snob, not a flagrant snob, but a natural, innocent one who tries very hard not to be snobbish. He was polite, not in the manner of one seeking favor, but in the manner of one granting it. His attitude was contagious. People did not question the reasons of his superiority. They took it for granted that such reasons existed. It became amusing at first to accept Monk Tui. Then it became distinctive and progressive. If this was a victory, Ellsworth did not seem conscious of it as such. He did not seem to care. He moved among all these unformed youths with the assurance of a man who has a plan, a long-range plan set in every detail, and who can spare nothing but amusement for the small incidentals of his way. His smile had a secret closed quality, the smile of a shopkeeper counting profits, even though nothing in particular seemed to be happening. He did not talk about God and the nobility of suffering. He talked about the masses. He proved to a rapt audience, at bull sessions lasting till dawn, that religion bred selfishness. Because, he stated, religion overemphasized the importance of the individual spirit. Religion preached nothing but a single concern, the salvation of one's own soul.
"To achieve virtue in the absolute sense," said Ellsworth Tui, "a man must be willing to take the foulest crimes upon his soul, for the sake of his brothers. To mortify the flesh is nothing. To mortify the soul is the only act of virtue. So you think you love the broad mass of mankind? You know nothing of love. You give $2 to a strike fund, and you think you've done your duty? You poor fools! No gift is worth a damn unless it's the most precious thing you've got. Give your soul. To a lie? Yes, if others believe it. To deceit? Yes, if others need it. To treachery, knavery, crime? Yes. To whatever it is that seems lowest and vilest in your eyes. Only when you can feel contempt for your own priceless little ego, only then can you achieve the true, broad peace of selflessness, the merging of your spirit with the vast collective spirit of mankind. There is no room for the love of others within the tight, crowded miser's hole of a private ego. Be empty in order to be filled. He that loveth his life shall lose it, and he that hateth his life in this world shall keep it unto life eternal." The opium peddlers of the church had something there, but they didn't know what they had. Self-abnegation? Yes, my friends, by all means, but one doesn't abnegate by keeping oneself pure and proud of its own purity. The sacrifice that includes the destruction of one's soul. Ah, but what am I talking about? This is only for heroes to grasp and to achieve.
He did not have much success among the poor boys working their way through college. He acquired a sizable following among the young heirs, the second and third generation millionaires. He offered them an achievement of which they felt capable. He graduated with high honors. When he came to New York, he was preceded by a small private fame. A few trickles of rumor had seeped down from Harvard about an unusual person named Ellsworth Tui. A few people, among the extreme intellectuals and the extremely wealthy, heard these rumors and probably forgot what they had heard, but remembered the name. It remained in their minds with a vague connotation of such things as brilliance, courage, idealism. People began to ooze toward Ellsworth Tui, the right kind of people, those who soon found him to be a spiritual necessity. The other kind did not come. There seemed to be an instinct about it. When someone commented on the loyalty of Tui's following, he had no title, program, or organization, but somehow his circle was called a following from the first. An envious rival remarked, "Tui draws the sticky kind. You know the two things that stick best, mud and glue." Tui overheard it and shrugged, smiling, and said, "Oh, come, come, there are many more. Adhesive plaster, leeches, taffy, wet socks, rubber girdles, chewing gum, and tapioca pudding." Moving away, he added over his shoulder, without smiling, "And cement." He took his master's degree from a New York university and wrote a thesis on collective patterns in the city architecture of the 14th century. He earned his living in a busy, varied, scattered way. No one could keep track of all his activities. He held the post of vocational advisor at the university. He reviewed books, plays, art exhibitions. He wrote articles, gave a few lectures to small, obscure audiences. Certain tendencies were apparent in his work. When reviewing books, he leaned toward novels about the soil rather than the city, about the average rather than the gifted, about the sick rather than the healthy. There was a special glow in his writing when he referred to stories about little people. Human was his favorite adjective. He preferred character study to action and description to character study. He preferred novels without a plot, and above all, novels without a hero. He was considered outstanding as a vocational advisor. His tiny office at the university became an informal confessional, where students brought all their problems, academic as well as personal. He was willing to discuss, with the same gentle, earnest concentration, the choice of classes or love affairs, or, most particularly, the selection of a future career. When consulted on love affairs, Tui counseled surrender. If it concerned a romance with a charming little pushover, good for a few drunken parties, let us be modern. And renunciation if it concerned a deep emotional passion, let us be grown up. When a boy came to confess a feeling of shame after some unsavory sexual experience, Tui told him to snap out of it. It was damn good for you. There are two things we must get rid of early in life, a feeling of personal superiority and an exaggerated reverence for the sexual act. People noticed that Ellsworth Tui seldom let a boy pursue the career he had chosen. No, I wouldn't go in for law if I were you. You're much too tense and passionate about it. A hysterical devotion to one's career does not make for happiness or success. It is wiser to select a profession about which you can be calm, sane, and matter-of-fact. Yes, even if you hate it. It makes for down-to-earthness. No, I wouldn't advise you to continue with your music. The fact that it comes to you so easily is a sure sign that your talent is only a superficial one. That's just the trouble, that you love it. Don't you think that sounds like a childish reason? Give it up. Yes, even if it hurts like hell. No, I'm sorry, I would so much like to say that I approve, but I don't. When you thought of architecture, it was a purely selfish choice, wasn't it? Have you considered anything but your own egotistical satisfaction? Yet a man's career concerns all society. The question of where you could be most useful to your fellow men comes first. It's not what you can get out of society. It's what you can give. And where opportunities for service are concerned, there's no endeavor comparable to that of a surgeon. Think it over. After leaving college, some of his protégés did quite well. Others failed. Only one committed suicide. It was said that Ellsworth Tui had exercised a beneficent influence upon them, for they never forgot him. They came to consult him on many things years later. They wrote him, they clung to him. They were like machines without a self-starter that had to be cranked up by an outside hand. He was never too busy to give them his full attention. His life was crowded, public, and impersonal as a city square. The friend of humanity had no single private friend. People came to him. He came close to no one. He accepted all. His affection was golden, smooth, and even, like a great expanse of sand. There was no wind of discrimination to raise dunes. The sand lay still, and the sun stood high. Out of his meager income, he donated money to many organizations. He was never known to have loaned a dollar to an individual. He never asked his rich friends to assist a person in need, but he obtained from them large sums and endowments for charitable institutions, for settlement houses, recreation centers, homes for fallen girls, schools for defective children. He served on the boards of all these institutions, without salary. A great many philanthropic undertakings and radical publications run by all sorts of people had a single connecting link among them. One common denominator, the name of Ellsworth M. Tui on their stationery. He was a sort of one-man holding company of altruism. Women played no part in his life. Sex had never interested him. His furtive, infrequent urges drew him to the young, slim, full-bosomed, brainless girls, The giggling little waitresses, the lisping manicurists, the less efficient stenographers, the kind who wore pink or orchid dresses and little hats on the back of their heads with gobs of blonde curls in front. He was indifferent to women of intellect. He contended that the family was a bourgeois institution, but he made no issue of it and did not crusade for free love. The subject of sex bored him. There was, he felt, too much fuss made over the damn thing. It was of no importance. There were too many weightier problems in the world. The years passed, with each busy day of his life like a small, neat coin dropped patiently into a gigantic slot machine, without a glance at the combination of symbols, without return. Gradually, one of his many activities began to stand out among the others. He became known as an eminent critic of architecture. He wrote about buildings for three successive magazines that limped on noisily for a few years and failed, one after the other. New voices, new pathways, new horizons. The fourth, New Frontiers, survived. Ellsworth Toohey was the only thing salvaged from the successive wrecks. Architectural criticism seemed to be a neglected field of endeavor. Few people bothered to write about buildings, fewer to read. Toohey acquired a reputation and an unofficial monopoly. The better magazines began calling upon him whenever they needed anything connected with architecture. In the year 1921, a small change occurred in Toohey's private life. His niece Catherine Halsey, the daughter of his sister Helen, came to live with him. His father had long since died, and Aunt Adeline had vanished into the obscure poverty of some small town. At the death of Catherine's parents, there was no one else to take care of her. Toohey had not intended to keep her in his own home, but when she stepped off the train in New York, her plain little face looked beautiful for a moment, as if the future were opening before her, and its glow were already upon her forehead, as if she were eager and proud and ready to meet it. It was one of those rare moments when the humblest person knows suddenly what it means to feel as the center of the universe, and is made beautiful by the knowledge. And the world, in the eyes of witnesses, looks like a better place for having such a center. Ellsworth, too, he saw this, and decided that Catherine would remain with him. In the year 1925 came Sermons in Stone, and fame. Ellsworth Toohey became a fashion. Intellectual hostesses fought over him. Some people disliked him and laughed at him. But there was little satisfaction in laughing at Ellsworth Toohey, because he was always first to make the most outrageous remarks about himself. Once at a party, a smug, boorish businessman listened to Toohey's earnest social theories for a while, and said complacently, "Well, I wouldn't know much about all that intellectual stuff. I play the stock market." "I," said Toohey, "play the stock market of the spirit, and I sell short." The most important consequence of Sermons in Stone was Toohey's contract to write a daily column for Gail Winans' New York Banner. The contract came as a surprise to the followers of both sides involved, and at first it made everybody angry. Toohey had referred to Winans frequently, and not respectfully. The Winans papers had called Toohey every name fit to print. But the Winans papers had no policy, save that of reflecting the greatest prejudices of the greatest number, and this made for an erratic direction, but a recognizable direction, nevertheless, toward the inconsistent, the irresponsible, the trite, and the maudlin. The Winans papers stood against privilege and for the common man, but in a respectable manner that could shock nobody. They exposed monopolies when they wished, they supported strikes when they wished, and vice versa. They denounced Wall Street, and they denounced socialism, and they hollered for clean movies, all with the same gusto. They were strident and blatant, and in essence, lifelessly mild. Ellsworth Toohey was a phenomenon much too extreme to fit behind the front page of the Banner. But the staff of the Banner was as unfastidious as its policy. It included everybody who could please the public or any large section thereof. It was said, "Gail Winans is not a pig, he'll eat anything." Ellsworth Toohey was a great success, and the public was suddenly interested in architecture. The Banner had no authority on architecture. The Banner would get Ellsworth Toohey. It was a simple syllogism. Thus, one small voice came into existence. The Banner explained its appearance by announcing, "On Monday, the Banner will present to you a new friend, Ellsworth M. Toohey, whose scintillating book, Sermons in Stone, you have all read and loved. The name of Mr. Toohey stands for the great profession of architecture. He will help you to understand everything you want to know about the wonders of modern building. Watch for One Small Voice on Monday to appear exclusively in the Banner in New York City. The rest of what Mr. Toohey stood for was ignored. Ellsworth Toohey made no announcement or explanation to anyone. He disregarded the friends who cried that he had sold himself. He simply went to work. He devoted One Small Voice to architecture once a month. The rest of the time it was the voice of Ellsworth Toohey saying what he wished said to syndicated millions. Toohey was the only Winant employee who had a contract permitting him to write anything he pleased. He had insisted upon it. It was considered a great victory by everybody except Ellsworth Toohey. He realized that it could mean one of two things. Either Winant had surrendered respectfully to the prestige of his name, or Winant considered him too contemptible to be worth restraining. One Small Voice never seemed to say anything dangerously revolutionary, and seldom anything political. It merely preached sentiments with which most people felt in agreement. Unselfishness, brotherhood, equality. I'd rather be kind than right. Mercy is superior to justice, the shallow-hearted to the contrary notwithstanding. Speaking anatomically, and perhaps otherwise, the heart is our most valuable organ. The brain is a superstition. In spiritual matters, there is a simple, infallible test. Everything that proceeds from the ego is evil. Everything that proceeds from love for others is good. Service is the only badge of nobility. I see nothing offensive in the conception of fertilizer as the highest symbol of man's destiny. It is fertilizer that produces wheat and roses. The worst folk song is superior to the best symphony. A man braver than his brothers insults them by implication. Let us aspire to no virtue which cannot be shared. I have yet to see a genius or a hero who, if stuck with a burning match, would feel less pain than his undistinguished average brother. Genius is an exaggeration of dimension. So is elephantiasis. Both may be only a disease. We are all brothers under the skin, and I, for one, would be willing to skin humanity to prove it. In the offices of the Banner, Ellsworth Toohey was treated respectfully and left alone. It was whispered that Gail Winant did not like him, because Winant was always polite to him. Alva Skerritt unbent to the point of cordiality, but kept a wary distance. There was a silent, watchful equilibrium between Toohey and Skerritt. They understood each other. Toohey made no attempt to approach Winant in any way. Toohey seemed indifferent to all the men who counted on the Banner. He concentrated on the others instead. He organized a club of Winant employees. It was not a labor union. It was just a club. It met once a month in the library of the Banner. It did not concern itself with wages, hours, or working conditions. It had no concrete program at all. People got acquainted, talked, and listened to speeches. Ellsworth Toohey made most of the speeches. He spoke about new horizons and the press as the voice of the masses. Gail Winant appeared at a meeting once, entering unexpectedly in the middle of a session. Toohey smiled and invited him to join the club, declaring that he was eligible. Winant did not join. He sat listening for half an hour, yawned, got up, and left before the meeting was over. Alva Skerritt appreciated the fact that Toohey did not try to reach into his field, into the important matters of policy. As a kind of return courtesy, Skerritt let Toohey recommend new employees when there was a vacancy to fill,